Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
What's good, internet? It's Friday, May 29th, and you're listening to Waypoint Radio, episode 317. I'm your host, Austin Walker, and I'm joined by Gita Jackson.
Hello.
Hi, and Kato is here with us, as always. Hey, Kato, how you doing?
Hi. Okay. It's a Monday today. We were talking
It's gross out today. Really is. We did not have an episode on Monday because of Memorial Day, and we decided not to try to cram an episode into what we knew would be a really packed week, which has since turned into a really shitty week. So briefly, before we get into our stuff, I do just want to say justice for George Floyd, justice for Ahmaud Arbery, who obviously that particular case is just still in the air. It is not a new thing, and those are two names among many. When I say justice, I don't mean like fire some police officers or press charges against people. I mean like substantial and systemic change. I mean like big picture shit. Justice is not something that gets done overnight, and it's not something that is achieved through individual action taken against individual actors. It's something that's achieved through the sort of large scale change that ensures that injustice is less possible. And that, you know, protocols and safeties are put in place and that people's lives are valued. And that is not something that happens quickly. I think in moments like this, it can be very easy to look for an out for why is anyone still mad about this? You know, the officers involved were fired or whatever. And so this is me saying, and you know, this goes beyond, you know, white supremacy in America. This goes to so many issues of oppression. Nothing gets changed just because individual actors were taken to task. You can take individual actors to task, and you should, because it helps, you know, indicate the fact that those systems, need to work in that way. But when it continues to happen in the first place over and over again, I think the message that is actually being sent to so many people is that your lives are only as valuable as much noise you can make. And in this case, we are making a lot of noise. So we are demanding that value be heard. In any case, with that out of the way, I think it's fair to talk about video games. I think a lot of us have been trying to play some stuff to keep our minds off of things or to keep our minds focused on things in different ways. I'm curious what y'all have been up to this week. Gita.
Hello. Hi. Well, you got me. Umurangi Generation is really freaking good. Completely.
It is.
Yeah, man. I know we talked about this like for a while in the pod last week. Last week. The passage of time is just a mystery to me.
Who knows anymore?
Honestly, who knows?
It's a nightmare. Yeah.
It's every day I wake up and some shit is happening on my timeline, and then I Ella walks all over me, and I'm like, "You're right. I should go back to sleep." And then I do. I really am enjoying this, particularly in this particular moment, which. As Austin just noted, there's, I feel like the more things change, the more things stay the same when it comes to police brutality, you know? And it's trying to relive some of the same exact conversations that I've had with my white peers, like when Black Lives Matter started, which was many, many years ago. And I'm begging for a little less talking and a little more listening from people. You know, I don't think I should beg for it, but here I am begging. Playing the Umurangi Generation in the midst of that stress and like being in a space where marginalized people are just developing their own community and are speaking their own language. The disconnect between the bounties and what you actually see outside of the viewfinder is what's most compelling about that game for me. And I really think if it took the edge off a little bit for me last night, because I understood that I'm not alone in this very specific kind of trauma of feeling like an outsider in the place where I live. It's like a really old trauma, and there are methods and there are ways that you can bring this to light and like make it explicable for people who don't speak the language, don't experience it. And hopefully from there, change is possible. So it brought me back from the brink of hopelessness a little bit.
The irony, of course, being that with Umurangi Generation, one of the things that that Kato pointed out to me over the weekend, or you know, it also comes up in that interview that I mentioned last time, the Umurangi, another thing I've learned is it's Rong-E, not Rong-Gi, if that makes sense. Umurangi, it's a what do you call that? What is that called? Is that a diphthong? What is that called? And there's like two. The NG swallowing. Sound. Yeah,
You're making a glottal stop, but I don't think that is the word.
I don't know what the... Yeah, anyway, is that the Umurangi Generation is asking you to care is a piece in which the one of the developers on the game, the lead, talks through kind of what some of the themes are of the game. And one of the things that we didn't really get into is the kind of core premise of the game, the reason it's called Red Sky or Umurangi Generation, aka Red Sky Generation, is that like these are the people who will be the last people to see the world. And I think so much of what is incredible about this game, which again for people who've missed previous conversations, is a game about doing photography kind of in a sort of near future cyberpunk-ish mid-apocalyptic New Zealand, it is this sort of like hope in the face of desperation and hope in the face of, or not even hope, culture in the face of, like joy in the face of what is the world ending, right? The world, everything falling apart all over the place, not being able to identify particular methods of hope. Or particular methods of like, how do we fix this? And insisting that we should still have community despite that, right? Mikado, you were the one who brought this up to me the other day, so I'm curious if you have any other thoughts on that.
I definitely, and I kind of messaged you about this, the idea of, because I had brought up the idea of like photography as a record and also a means to disseminate information that may be, like we talked about, maybe not listened to if not in like this kind of not sanitized but more easily digestible form of the image, but something part of like a record is the idea that there will be somebody to look back at a thing. And I was really kind of stricken, especially by, not going to say exactly what happens, but the like last area in the game and, the idea of a kind of finality that, photography doesn't, There's a kind of finality in the end of this game that, in a way, twists the idea of using photography to document this. That is a little bit like, I don't know. It feels almost what's the word I'm looking for? Not didactic, but like precautionary, I suppose. You know, that. There's a certain not privilege exactly, but like this idea that knowing that in the current time, like you can still, or hoping that in the current time you can still change the course of history, where for these people in this game it's too late. Right, like the actors have already kind of made their mistakes.
Right. And right. People, I mean, that is the...
Right. The individual people are kind of living out the end of their time on their terms, kind of, but like only on, yeah, insofar as the people in power have already kind of screwed the pooch, so to speak.
Yeah, I've been noticing this in real life. I mean, I've more recently, I think just because I'm locked inside and stressed out all the time, I'm just growing my patience for, let's say, white nonsense. It's just gotten like a lot. It's just a lot lower than it used to be. I used to, you know, you grow up with a lot of white people. You learn how to tune certain things out and try not to let it get to you. But this most recently, especially after back-to-back Palouse murders, I'm just over it. Today, like, the moment I realized I just needed to get off the timeline and, like, do something nice for my brain was when I saw a white person retweet this video of, like, a black child crying on camera about the riots and, like, very, like, eloquently explaining why riots occur, which is, you know, he was saying, if the people here can't trust the police, then once the police kills one of them and they don't have anyone to go to, they're just going to riot. And just, you know, just true. But it's like, you're forcing, like, this kid couldn't have been more than 12. And you could hear his voice breaking on camera, like an actual literal child. And it's must feel very good for some people to see images like that in the face of tragedy. But that person, when the camera stopped running, continued to exist. And I think Umurangi generation, more than anything, brings that thought to the front of my mind. Like, when I'm given a bounty to take a picture of the word cops, we talked about this last time, I know that the person who receives that picture will be happy with their picture of the word cops. I don't know what they're going to do with that. But the character I play took that picture and then still had to live in the world where they, you know, graffiti says cops come here to kill us for a reason. I just think it's a good time to think more mindfully about the things you share on social media, how you respond to tragedy, and the ways in which responses to tragedy can also be dehumanizing.
Mm-hmm. The quote that I was trying to reference and I couldn't pull off out of the top of my head from Faulkner, who is the lead dev on it, is, "I chose Umurangi generation, you know, Red Sky generation, because the idea was to talk about how our generation is coming of age at the moment, having to deal with older generations destroying the earth in front of us. And we can't really do anything about it. We can go and protest, sure, but in terms of being the people who actually push the buttons, we're limited in that space. The idea in choosing that title was that someday there is going to be a last generation, a generation who is in the position we are in at the moment. They're going to have to just sit by and watch. There's going to be a point where we can't fix it, a generation that won't have the same hope that I have at the moment." And I think that that is so fascinating because it's such a, it puts on its head what I think a lot of other developers would do with this core concept. Mm-hmm. Because I think there would be a turn. There would be the moment of like, and then you took the photograph that changes the world. Right. Then you took the photograph that reveals the truth about the situation. And I think that the game rejects that framing. And that's a framing that I think gets brought forward a lot. And we talked about the value of photography and the kind of lines around depicting, shooting the effects of war, shooting the effects of trauma, and like what the benefits there are, what the philosophy around and discussion around the sort of ethics of photography are. But I love the idea that someone stepped forward, that this developer stepped forward and said, like, all right, let's bracket off what we think are the values of, you know, photography, documentation, creative work, in regards to political change or in regards to saving us. What remains? Is it still valuable then? And I think the game insists that it is, which is fascinating. And for what it's worth, the thing that I like about it is not that it says photography can't save us. It's that it says that photography could save us is not the reason why photography is meaningful. Right. Do you know what I mean? And I think that there's a degree to which it's like the photography is in this game adjacent to dance, music, visual art in the style of murals and graffiti, All sorts of fashion, all sorts of other types of expression that happen for this generation of people as depicted through you and your friends and the other groups that you kind of bounce around, the kind of car culture that you see, the people doing b-boy shit in the subway on the one level, people who are like, there's visual artists who have like people who've built monuments or people who've built shrines or, vigils for people. Those things happen again and again, and none of them can save that group, right? The fact that there's like the second or third level, I think it's the third level, you find all these memorials for someone who the community's lost. And it's not that like those memorials bring anyone back. And even in that case, it's not necessarily that those memorials will change the political truth of the world for those people. It's not going to get the UN to stop occupying their space. It's not going to change the sort of events of the macro level plot of this game, which I just need to like pause for a second and just be like, huge props for this game for being able to produce this degree of conversation from us over 3 weeks. Without dialogue, without exposition, without there being a title card that says in the year blah 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 blah. It has such a strong sense of environmental storytelling through communicating stuff about the world through just visual language, through music, through space. It's incredible. But going back to it, all of those things are valuable, you know, in spite of their inability to change the situation. Or rather, they understand that part of what changing the situation is that expression can help float a community for a while. It can help ease suffering and pain. It can give us joy in the face of abject horror. And those are things that allow us to continue living. And you know, insofar as if we can go back to our old Ava podcasts, right? Mm-hmm. The chance, the openness, the open possibility that tomorrow could theoretically change something, right? It can be in a moment of desperation, it can be really hard to move on even a day. And because tomorrow looks bad too, right? Because you know tomorrow won't fix things. You're not going to wake up. But there is this sort of like potential, the potentiality of the future is open in such a way that could something happen? And if it were to happen, would we be ready to capitalize on it? Would we be ready to swing into action? Would we have the morale necessary? Would we understand ourselves as a community? Would we understand what we believe in and who we are willing to fight for? And I think those are the things that something like doing photography in the face of apocalypse help are a great analogy for, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know that releasing this podcast is going to ever affect the situation of white supremacy in America. I don't think it will. I don't think it will, right? Like, we are one voice in a sea being ignored. But if the opportunity, if the door opens, I want people to be ready to run through it, right? We can't open the door, but we can give you some sneakers. You know what I mean?
Like, we can get
you ready to go. And that is, that is, I think, part of what is so fascinating. And it, you have to, it has to be there's like a leap of faith quality to it, which is like you have to get up every morning and do the work of getting prepared just in case the door opens. You can't just assume the door will never open. And that's so frustrating because it means every day you get up, you get ready to go somewhere, you can't go anywhere. But one day there is the possibility that things align just right. Enough momentum gets moving. Enough people realize other people are ready for large scale change, or nothing changes and we all suffer until we die. But along the way, we've taken a lot of good pictures, right?
Yeah. I think along the lines of what you're saying about this game, just making it just an argument for the art for the sake of art. And usually when that argument is made by non-marginalized people, I hear it sort of like in praise of frivolity, you know, in praise of frivolousness. And there is something frivolous about art in and of itself, but I think that this game makes a strong case for no art actually being frivolous, that even in the face of absolute nothingness, it's better to have a voice to express yourself with than to not. It's better to be able to put that frame around your environment and contextualize it for yourself, for your community, for other people, than to not. I'm reading right now Six and Lou's Supernova Era, which is this incredible book. Basically, there is a supernova in this book, and everyone over the age of 13 gets a dose of fatal radiation and will die within a year. And they have to train everyone dying happens like in the first chapter, and then the children just have to take over. And they talk a lot about in the book about how culture is going to change now that no adults are alive, and what that means, and how that moves things, and what that's going to mean about the old world and the new world. Like, the reason the book's called Supernova Era is because there's just now two eras of humanity, one where there were adults basically all the time, and another where 13-year-olds had to become president. God, this is great. The American president is like a cherubic little boy, and his chief of staff is like an evil little boy who does drugs. I love him. It's interesting to read that book and play this game at the same time, just because I'm reading two different perspectives on like what happens to culture when it's over, when it all ends. You know, the culture of the supernova era in this book is going to be completely different from the culture that came before, influenced by it, sure, but like not the same thing at all. And it's just been making my brain do backflips. Anyway, I think this game is good. That's what I meant to say.
Though I do think the game does a really smart thing too, of just contrasting the sort of emergent culture stuff from the communities it shows versus the stuff that is still being made somewhere off screen and peddled. All of the like terrible movie posters for like action hero shit that is like
Three Nights in Kowloon or something.
Right?
Like that.
Yeah. That stuff. There's definitely like stuff that's like the equivalent of kind of like American army apologia, that's just like, our soldiers are sad, and that means that you got to remember, even though they killed a lot of brown people, they're people too. And it's like that style of movie poster is everywhere in this world, or people who are like trying to, but it's mixed in with stuff. Like, it's not like completely dismissive of the idea of film. You know what I mean? It's definitely mixed in with stuff of people who are trying to make stuff that makes sense of the world, or trying to like emphasize that like, actually, it's kind of cool when you fight giant monsters. And that stuff is it's fascinating to see the range of kind of artistic production that is gestured at in the world. I don't know. We've gone on for it for 20 minutes again, but I really, really love it.
Yeah, no, it's really good.
If my schedule slows down, I'm going to do a stream one of these days. So we'll see.
You totally should. Oh, yeah. Man, it's a perfect stream game. The only thing I don't like about the game is when I can't find something, and then I get really mad at myself and have to take a little walk around the apartment. But that's a me problem.
Yeah, hit me up. I have gotten all of the. I mean, yes, I've now put 10 hours into this game, and this game is not 10 hours long. Like, it's 7 10-minute levels you can totally beat.
You start looking at stuff in the 10-minute levels, and then you want to keep looking at stuff, and then like have 5 minutes later, I'm like, I have objectives.
I have bonus objectives. I can't find these film canisters. I found all the film canisters. The bonuses that you get for them are sick. I'm like of two minds, because it's like, now that I've spent 10 hours in this game, I know these spaces incredibly well, and that feels cool. But also, some of the things that they lock up behind the unlockable like bonus objective stuff is so. There are some of those things are so important for the photo taking process in terms of like different lenses you unlock, in terms of things like, remember Kata, you were like, why can't I just stay zoomed in and take photos? Not say look through the viewfinder and take, it's like, well, yeah, you can, if you get all the bonus objectives on level, whatever. And it's like,
it's not like your eyes upgrade or your arm upgrades to like hold the camera more. It's
the final upgrade is a dope futuristic thing, though, for what it's worth, is what I will say.
Okay. I'm
excited. They do some like sci-fi shit with the final upgrade. It's sick. So maybe I'll do a stream of that. Any other final thoughts on this, or should we move on to other stuff that people are checking out?
Yeah, I'm good. Right. The music whips, that's all.
Shout out to
the soundtrack.
The music
is off the chain.
It's incredible.
My God.
It's so good. I briefly want to shout out two other little things. One is a game called Totem, T-O-T-E-M, that's on Itch. I've only put like 30 or 40 minutes into it, but it's only like 2 hours long, is my understanding. I'll just read the pitch from the itch page. It's something strange has appeared on Earth. Multiple gigantic beings with unique languages, and you're the only one that can deter them. You are the translator. And it is like a first person. It's like an arrival like. It's like a.
Excuse me?
I've linked you. It's a little gamier than what you might think a game with this pitch is like, in the sense that, like, all right, so I'll just give you the first one that I did is an entity called Wrecking Ball shows up, and Wrecking Ball is this giant orb with like other weird polygons sticking out of it, and it speaks through like symbols, right? And the symbols are very broad things, like there's like a squiggle, and a squiggle means verb. There is like a this is a verb. There is a door with an arrow going into it, and that means entry. There's a door with an arrow going away from it, that means exit, right? There's like a picture of the galaxy, and that means galaxy. There's a picture of a human heart, and that means love. And you are trying to do like dialogue choices while looking at this gigantic creature in front of you that looks like a walking like nuclear disaster about to happen. And it's switching between two like selves. It's switching between an empathetic and a logical self. And your goal is to keep the logical self in this first one. The goal is to keep the logical self interested long enough for you to like convince the emotional self that you are not a threat and that it should go away. But then the second one that I did is this gigantic walking nightmare monster that communicates through these like howling horns, these like just like that style of alien communication thing going back to Close Encounters, basically, right? And you communicate with that one. Similarly, there was like a lexicon. You're basically picking musical notes to play back with a kind of translator's guide in your escape key. You hit escape key to bring up a menu that's like, okay, this means self, this means God, this means, you know, prey, this means opposite. And you're kind of stringing together, you're picking sentences that have strung these words together to vaguely mean ideas or mean sentences that are like, you know, not very nuanced. And in that one, you're trying to scare this creature away, but not scare it so much that it attacks you. And in that one, you can also launch these terrifying spikes at it from that feel like they look like they're from a Dragon Age game or something. These big bright blue and red spikes, but they're launched as if they're like javelin missiles from off screen, and they slam into this creature to either tranquilize it or enrage it, because you don't want it to get all the way unraged either, because if it's not angry at all, it means that it's not regarding you as a threat at all, and so that means that it's just going to stomp on you and move on. And it's all of this is done in first person, all of this is done in like of the woods, the foggy woods. The developer very much took inspiration from some Simon Stollenhag stuff and basically set out to make a game in which the encounter with an alien, the encounter with aliens is still tense and scary and still filled with conflict, but is not like you don't have a gun. What if you couldn't shoot the aliens, yeah, right? There's a really good blog post up. The developer's name is Shackles, and that it is, again, it's Totem, TOTEM, on, or Shackles maybe, shakles.itch.io/totem. Definitely worth checking out. I think it's free right now, and normally it's $5. Give this person $5 for this cool thing. And shout outs, by the way, to the fan who linked me this, because I was like, wow, yeah, this is cool.
Yeah, that is.
The other first person thing that actually maybe there is some connection here with Umurangi is Sludge Life. You put a little bit of time into this, right?
Yeah. It also has very early on a camera, but it's not a camera game.
It does. It's not a camera game. You can look at the pictures you took.
Yeah, which is nice.
But it's not.
I love how many cameras we're getting in games recently. Yeah. I'm into it. We're playing, it's essentially a graffiti tagging game, which ends up amounting to a lot of platforming puzzles and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And basically the setting is a shipyard slash prison question mark where there's a strike happening. And like that's kind of part of the whole shtick, obviously, is like moving through the space and talking to people, kind of figuring out what's happening. And it's got a very kind of crass, it leans in a way into a crass like Adult Swimness, but not in a like, it never goes the full Rick and Morty IMO. Yeah. Like it's
good.
Yeah.
don't do that.
But it has, yeah, it definitely has this a really cool look and a really fun kind of way to move around the space. This is one where like I like got into this game. I was like, oh, I wish I could move like half the speed in Umurangi. Right? Yeah. I was like, oh, yeah. Here we go. This is one where like because they know you're gonna be jumping around things a lot more. Like they've like focused on that so much more. So
but you can mantle like, in Sludge Life, which is yeah, very useful. So like good. Climb up, not like climb up, but like I mean, you can also climb up ladders and stuff.
Yeah.
But you can like if you get enough of your body over the edge, you'll pull yourself up. But I definitely wish Umurangi had that.
Yeah,
for sure.
Yes,
I have and, just fallen off so many things on Umurangi. Yeah, yeah. Oh my god. Anyway,
but yeah, it's really it's got a very you know. It's, you know, I feel like there's a sense people get when you say the word irreverent nowadays. That's
annoying.
somehow become inextricably tied with the idea of like South Park humor, and this is a different kind of.
This is more like Gorillaz, Kid Robot, NERD. Like that's the vibe I get from
totally.
You know what I mean? That style of like. Street, a certain subset of streetwear, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's definitely trying, I mean, it's a game about graffiti, right? And so you're tagging stuff. There's good music in it. It doesn't hit me as strong as I wish it did. I think partially because right now I'm so early enough where I'm like, all I'm doing is doing jumping puzzles to tag stuff, but there's definitely some other stuff going on in terms of the world building, and like every once in a while you stumble into kind of a fun little mini, not a puzzle necessarily, but I guess there's a couple things with a puzzle. Like I found someone who was like locked out of their comms tower that they're supposed to be working in, and you're like, all right, well, I bet I can get in there. I bet I can find a jump somewhere that lets me climb up something and then jump into this place. And I did, and I went in there, and then that is how I got a new disc for my computer that gave me like a satellite camera of the area, which is like a map, but I don't know why I would ever use that map necessarily, but it's so cool. And it's like, oh, okay, I bet I'm going to keep unlocking cool things for my laptop. This is a game where you hit escape. Here's what this game is. This is a game where you hit escape to pull up a laptop and look at your like menu screen, and that's where you like change your settings or look at the photos you've taken. And when you hit escape again, the camera returns to first person mode and your character throws the laptop on the ground.
every time you take a photo, every time you take the camera away from your face, you just throw it in front of you.
Yeah,
and it's still you don't have to go pick it up. You still can just pull it right back up.
It.
But it's just like you're tossing shit every time.
It's like one of those Borderlands guns that you throw when you're done and you just summon a new one. Yeah, it's good. It's good.
It's very
I think that's free right now on Epic.
Yeah.
Here's what I'll say. It's definitely worth looking at a trailer and be like, oh yeah, I fuck around with this for free for a few hours,
right?
And if you look at it and you're like, I don't like the style, then yeah, there's not like some secret thing there for you necessarily if your first blush account of it is. I mean, again, I'm early. Maybe by hour 3 or 4, I'd be like, actually, it's worth it. Even if you don't think this looks good, you should still play it. But right now, I'm just like, yeah, give it a look. If it looks like it looks good to you, try it.
Yeah.
All right, let's take a quick break. When we come back, Gita, I know you have some more Sim stuff to talk about.
Oh boy, yes, I do.
All right. Well, we will be right back.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
All right, we are back. Gita, what's going on? You said that you had a big Sims project?
Yeah, I'm starting an elaborate project, which first I will explain to you a very fun thing that I think that other Simmers do that I'm embarking upon. So as you now must know, like by heart, my favorite Simmer is Lil Simsy. Is a recent college graduate who is really obsessed with building things in The Sims. And I've been watching her content that's she's an EA game changer, which means that she got access to the Eco Lifestyle Pack early, just like I did. And she's putting up a lot of videos where she's going through EA's builds in the game and renovating them. So making sometimes minor, sometimes major changes to them to just make them make a little bit more sense as houses. Sometimes EA Max's Sims teams, you know I love you, but sometimes there's weird things that are wrong with those builds. Like in the Eco Lifestyle Pack, Simsy pointed out that there's one building where the roof texture is not consistent across all of the different roof pieces, so it just looks like an accident and probably is. Well, waka waka. Hopefully they see that before they ship it. But what she has done, because she likes doing these renovations so much, is she's renovated every single lot in the game in every single expansion. So there is a save file that she has distributed that she calls the Simsy save, where it's all the lots are different. They're all renovated, some are major, some minor. All of them have all new Sims that live in them as well. So like there's a bunch of new Sims with her personalized story. She's written little descriptions for all of them also. And it's tremendous. It's tremendous. It's a lot of work and it's really kind of remarkable. So of course I decided I wanted to do something like that too. So I'm right now in the city of San Myshuno, literally right now trying to figure out how to rebuild all of the apartments to feel more like apartments to me. I feel like I really like this one thing that The Sims has. This has a town that is just empty lots that you can build whatever you want on called Newcrest. And I have built up Newcrest a lot of times trying to, you can build any different kind of building in this game. So I've made a bunch of coffee shops. I've made a bunch of gyms. I made a library that I called the Rec Room because I put like every single skill building item inside of it. Because, like even it has a basketball court. I don't know. Cool library, I guess. I mean, it's really, really fun to literally build your own world. And as much as I like the stuff that comes with every pack, and I like seeing what EA has done, I'm so interested in creating a world that is truly my own and then pressing play on the simulation and just seeing what happens generations down the line. Mm. So this is my first step in making that possible for me. I probably will share it with people, but my main motivation for this is to make this game even more my own by remaking the world in my image.
What are your like specific like aims? Like what will make this the Gita pack or like the Gita world?
The Gita save.
The Gita save. Sorry. Yes.
It's okay. It's similar terminology. It's confusing. First of all, I'm trying to think like about different tones that I want to give different neighborhoods. They already have general themes. San Myshuno is San Francisco. Dodoy. But the apartments in here, I've only lived in apartments in two different states, Chicago and New York City. And I feel like the layouts of these apartments are much too big and have too much room. So I've been trying to compress everything, make everything cramped and smaller and feel more lived in and feel cozier. I don't know what I'm going to do when I get to the mansions, but they're going to be very small mansions with very large yards, I think. That's part of it. I need intimacy, I think, is what I'm trying to create here. Sometimes EA's builds can be very empty, and I understand why, because this game has to like run on anything, essentially. And if you put too many items on a lot, then it'll take a very long time for that lot to load in older machines. that makes sense. But then you get to a mansion and it, you go to a hallway and there's like one table in it. And you're like, this is the saddest house in the entire world. That's part of it. I also think architecturally, I want to get way more specific about styles. I have been practicing building craftsman houses on stream and just in my spare time.
Can you explain what that is?
A craftsman house is a specific architectural style that's native to the Americas. Frank Lloyd Wright made a lot of craftsmen.
Okay.
Yeah, that's the arts and crafts movement. Craftsmen are less ostentatious, I think, than most of the Frank Lloyd Wrights that people are thinking about. But it's all about, in general, I like architecture that uses a lot of natural woods, natural materials, colors that blend to the environment. Yeah.
Stonework. A little bit here from what I'm looking at. Yeah. Okay. Cool.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of not necessarily wooden slats outside, sometimes just painted concrete, that kind of stuff. Using materials that are easy to come by and not like inexpensive, and using them well. The general idea for those kinds of homes also is like smaller bedrooms, big living area. Because the way you live, you know, how you live in a home influences the way that you spend your time. And by having smaller bedrooms, it means that families are forced to associate with each other in the living room or dining areas, which I think is a really sweet notion. So there's that. There are a lot of really good architectural items for craftsman houses in The Sims, so I've been really happy about that. I think I've been trying to think about also like what kinds of people would live in these houses. And when I go in to decorate them, that's always been where I end up creating really fun little stories about the people who would live there. Let me go really quickly to a house I'd recently built on a stream where I started thinking about what kind of human beings would live in this house. And then more generally, what kind of people would live in this world that the Geeta Jackson save. Let's see. I built this incredibly beautiful house. Was it this one? Nope. None of these, but it was really good. I built this house where I was thinking about, like, okay, this is an enormous craftsman house, and there's got to be a family that lives here. So I started thinking about, well, there's got to be, it's a 3-bedroom, so maybe one of the kids is a child and the other one is a teenager. And then teenagers and children decorate their rooms in different ways. Children often have their parents decorate their rooms for them, or have like things in that room that they've made themselves. So I was able for the kids' room to just throw a bunch of dinosaur stuff in there. I do not care about the way Windows Defender summary. Sorry about that. I threw a bunch of dinosaur stuff in there because I was thinking, okay, children like dinosaurs. But then how is that child different from the teenager who I decided was an older sister, younger brother, older sister? And in there, I put a lot of purples down in the room. And then I found these beaded curtains. And I was like, what if this little girl is going through her like hippie phase where she gets obsessed with everything that happened in the 60s and 70s, which is a real phase that many girls go through. I thought I didn't. And then I remembered I got really obsessed with that Vincent D'Onofrio Abby Hoffman movie for like 3 months when I was 16. it's really weird. So from there, it's like, okay, what kind of parents raised these two kids? And I started thinking, you know, well, there's one child who's like clearly an overachiever, little science nerd who's really into dinosaurs, and another who is rebelling in some way. So these parents are pretty average, but I bet that they have like eclectic tastes and are, you know, collect interesting furniture and have a very well decorated home. They're really pushing their children to succeed academically. So I ended up giving them like all this mid-century modern furniture that's incredibly beautiful. I'm so proud of this house and it makes me very happy. I'm looking at it now. I gave them a little reading nook in the living area. I'll just throw the screenshot in there. So it's just like I'm trying to figure out the narrative of this place. And I feel like the more houses I make, the more that I understand the narrative of this place is about just communities that look and feel more similar to the household that I grew up in. rather than a lot of the sort of white suburban stuff that you end up seeing from Simmers and in The Sims. That's a little cute little place. Makes me very happy, and I would like to be here.
It's very cute. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Well, keep us up to date. Let us know when the Gita save is ready. Please, this is a very cute living room. Cool. I think that's a really cool project. Is that like an ongoing thing besides Little Simsies save? Like, is there...
Yeah.
That's really
a
cool.
A bunch of people have done this. This is... Simsy didn't invent it. She's okay, just like gotcha. The most popular one.
Right, I got you.
She's shown off a couple of different ones on her channel. So people get really, really elaborate with this, and like sometimes they'll like remake it so that it's like, oh, all these neighborhoods are like dystopian and futuristic, or mm-hmm. oh, I've seen Simmers do like redo things so that it's like a specific historical period and stuff like that. I'm mostly like your average millennial person that likes mid-century modern furniture and just decorating every single house in the same way. It makes you try it's a good project for people who like building because it forces you to try new things. Because mm-hmm. after a while, you're just going to get fucking sick of putting down the same goddamn chair every single time. Yeah.
Fair enough. God. Yeah. All right. I think that's everything we've played this week. It's been a really busy week, as I said. So let's quickly take a dip in the question bucket to round out the show and give us a real runtime. if you have questions, you can send them to gaming@vice.com. This one comes in from Waz, who gives us really the question to end all questions. What is better, pizza bites or pizza rolls?
Fuck.
Oh, shit.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Listen. Should we all decide and say it at the same time?
Yeah, hold on.
Okay.
Let me make up my mind first. Okay.
You gotta go to time that is.
Yeah, right. No, I'll just do a countdown. It was 3, 2, 1, and then we say the thing. Okay?
Okay.
3, 2, 1. Bites.
Bites.
We're linked. We're synced.
Great.
I don't burn my mouth.
It was close. Yes, exactly.
That's why. Burn my mouth.
That's what it is.
That's 100% it. You put the bites in your mouth, then you're like, oh, I can just pop them in my mouth. And then the roof of your mouth is burnt for days.
Totino's pizza rolls. They're so good. They taste good, but yeah, they're dangerous.
Stephen Totillo's pizza rolls.
That's right. That's the classic Totino's pizza roll. Uh-huh. I don't know why when I was like, it's good. I like it. I sounded like that kid who likes the chicken sandwich. You know the kid I'm talking about? Have you not heard this kid?
Yeah. Yes.
The 11-year-old kid. People should just Google 11-year-old kid loves fried chicken. Actually, Kato, can you just put this in the thing? Can you just put this in the podcast, please?
Sure. Really? Yeah.
This kid. Thank you, right. Get ready. We're just going to play on this together, and you can just drop it in. It's 16 seconds. I don't care if we get sued.
Yeah, it's fine.
This kid's a joy. 11-year-old kid, loves fried chicken. Such a great kid. Ready?
Yeah.
3, 2, 1, play.
Well, I'm here in the freezing cold getting free chicken sandwiches because the food tastes great. I mean, it's chicken. It's fried chicken. It's fried chicken.
I love the name of this, too.
I like fried chicken.
Oh, it's so good. He has three mortgages. I just know it. Yeah. I just know it.
I was about to say.
Oh, it's incredible.
A middle-aged man in a child's body.
It's so good. He's right.
When people say they can see someone be a dad before they are actually a father, it's like, this kid is going to be a dad someday.
It's incredible.
The first comment is, he sounds like he already went through life twice.
He did. Yes. And he knows the one true thing is he likes chicken sandwiches. They're good.
They're good.
They're very good.
Listen.
What else do you need?
Listen.
What's better than this?
What's better than this? Chicken sandwiches. there is another question here. This one comes in from June. Who writes in, last year, I got back into photography after a long time away. I got in very deep very quickly, and I averaged about a roll or two of film every week. It was the thing I was doing. When the lockdown started, though, I slowed down at least. Wandering around Chicago for hours didn't really feel like a responsible thing to do. And there's only so many pictures I can take of my succulents. Admittedly, I haven't played many photo games, but Umurangi Generation is one of the only games I've played that captures the sheer awkwardness of composing a photo. Both in real life and Umurangi, there are times when I've been crouching in some strange position, standing in a weird spot, or figuring out that I am, in fact, far too close to be able to focus how I want. While I've technically finished it, Umurangi will undoubtedly be a game I come back to when I desperately want to go out on hours-long photo walk in the time of COVID. My question is this. Are there any experiences from pre-lockdown that you're missing, and are there any games or other media that capture that experience? Thanks, and keep up the good work, June. Like, Umurangi is like part of why it's connecting for me so strong is definitely that, is definitely the feeling of being in a lived-in space.
Yes.
I'm trying to think, what else, if there are other things. I think, to some degree, part of the reason I've fallen hard into Valorant is being able to play with, hear more voices per day.
Right. Yes. Yes, for it's like, sure.
I've been playing that game with people who, like, I'm friends with on the internet, but not people who I've ever played a game with before, in some cases, right? Or, like, maybe, like, We did Mech Warrior Online one night, or we did like 4 PUBG games together. But a big part of why I've been playing that is definitely that, and I don't mean that to like undersell the people I'm playing with as cool people so much as emphasizing that like I'm not a super social person, and tend to be able to get the sociality I need in a day of being in an office or in the world. Right. And I just don't have that now. And so it has been very fun to connect to people who I already like a lot, and play some games online with them. So that's one for sure. But that has less to do with Valorant and more to do with, you know, just the not seeing people.
Yeah.
Yeah. I absolutely have just latched on to competitive games and multiplayer games because of the pandemic to try to get that element of socialization that I am desperately missing. I do consider myself a social person, but I also feel like I pretty much get what I need out of socialization if I go to the office. Mostly because when I'm at the office, I just get up and walk around and talk to people all day long. You know, I miss that and like need it desperately and thinking about it constantly. But I feel like that I'm hitting my limit on competitive games and what they can do for me, though. Because I am starting to remember what it was I don't like about competitive games and the ways that people sometimes are when they play them. There's a lot of people who are like new to playing competitive games that are playing right now, and I just am loathing this idea I'm having of them playing with friends and then discovering a whole new side to their friends that they don't love, you know?
Sure.
But
sure.
I think, though, like I just wrote this whole essay about this. Really, like The Sims is just giving me this experience. Like it's not so much, I've started to understand how much of my experience of going outside and walking the city is about the architecture and how much I like to think about the history of the city through looking at its architecture, imagining what facades used to look like, et cetera, et cetera. So The Sims, and I'm like about to buy House Flipper for the same reason, to engage with architecture in that way again, and to think about history in that way. I feel in a lot of America, you don't feel very engaged with history. So I feel like very lucky to live in a city with brownstones that are old as shit, like buildings that are pre-war and stuff. Mm-hmm. So not being able to explore parts of the city, have that culture, it's just made The Sims, like having it in my brain so that I can remember this thing I like, feel very necessary.
I kind of same with Umurangi, but the other thing that I keep thinking about is just having a nice time in a museum. And the fucking Animal Crossing Museum is so nice. It's so like aesthetically pleasing to just walk around there every once in a while. Just like, I'm going to sit here and let butterflies fly around me.
The butterfly little hutch area is by far, it's so good. It makes me so happy.
Yeah. I think that's another one.
Huh. I built the robot. I did it.
Yay.
I have my Gundam.
Hell yeah.
And I have not played since. It felt like beating the game. I need to go back in. It's just been a busy couple of weeks for me, so I have not. But yeah, I did it and that felt good.
I've stopped buying turnips, which I never thought would happen.
I've also stopped. Well, like what else am I supposed to buy at this point? Like, what do I need money for? I don't need money for anything. I'm good.
Yeah, that's,
I'm
good. Sounds you just guys chilling, fuck around with your island if you want, but.
Mm-hmm. You guys want to hear something that feels like a secret, but isn't a secret, but still feels like a secret to me?
Sure, yeah.
I fell off, man. I stopped playing. I stopped playing Animal Crossing.
Yeah.
Was there something that did it, or was it just like, I'm done, I'm good?
I mean, part of it was I moved my Switch from my bedroom to the living room because I wanted to let my roommate play Animal Crossing. She eventually got her own Switch, so I never turned it back, and I used to just wake up and grab the Switch and immediately go into Animal Crossing. Yeah. So I stopped doing that. That was part of it. But also, the minute it started feeling like a chore, I was like, no, I'm not going to let it get that way. I'm going to put it down, and then when I want to play it again, I will pick it up. Sure. And I just haven't felt that want. I'm getting the itch scratched in other places. Plus, I kind of want to wait just to see what villagers move out and who I get next.
sure. Why not?
I couldn't get... Who's the horny bunny villager? There's one villager that wears fishnets and she's a bunny. The horny bunny villager. Hang on.
Let's see.
Horny bunny villager Animal Crossing. Not Zipper. He's not horny. And I think her name is Tiffany. Zipper is not horny. I refuse to believe this. I think her name is Tiffany. She has like a roulette, like casino themed home. She wears fishnets and a long t-shirt. And on her like amiibo card, it's her looking over her shoulder with her like little bunny butt poof showing. I'm not into it. She seems fine, just not on my island. Okay, put on some fucking pants. So I needed her to leave, and I couldn't get her to leave. I stopped talking to her, and then every day she was still there, and I was like, I need to not get so angry at a virtual rabbit. I need to not do this.
I don't know if have you had anyone leave when you're not there?
Yes, not when I'm not there.
Right,
only when I'm there.
I think you have to actually. You know, they got those little thought bubbles above their head sometimes. I think you actually have to engage with them then, and they'll ask you if they should leave before actually leaving in this one. Because I haven't had anyone leave when I'm not there.
Well, I think that's stupid.
Which is a trap.
So Gita is done with Animal Crossing.
I'm never returning. As long as a horny bunny is there,
the bunny
I'm not.
Wearing fishnets, that's it.
I don't like it. I am. I'm not usually anti-horny. It's just like, I'm here to have a nice time, you know? Mm-hmm. I'm here not to be horny. I'm not here to be horny today.
That's why I'm here. Right.
That's why I'm here. I'm here to just be in Animal Crossing and not think about how men get horny for fishnets. You know? Like, I'm over it.
Fair enough.
I'm over thinking about the male gaze when I'm playing a video game.
God. Fair enough. All right. I'll give maybe one more question before here's a quick one. This is not a question. This is me saying this person's right. Like Austin, I've been playing some Fallout 76, but after 10 or so hours, I've discovered something odd. I can't internalize the controls. I find myself constantly hitting the wrong button or having to stare at the UI to figure out what I want to do next. I don't think this has ever been an issue with me, even with other Fallouts. So I'm curious if you have other issues where a game control just doesn't click. P.S. As a person living in West Virginia, Fallout 76 depiction of the state really sucks. But that's a whole other can of worms. That game's UI is bad, or like it is inconsistent what buttons do. So sometimes it's like if I'm to pull up the inventory or to pull up the UI, it's not the same button to put the UI away. And switching between that might not be true, but it's something like that.
Sure.
And then the big one is that like the button to from one menu onto another one, I think, is on the triggers instead of the bumpers, but in other inventory or in other UI elements, the bumpers are what move between like left and right. Do you know what I mean? Like if you're looking at the top level of a menu and it's like status, items, radio, that's triggers. But then on other menus, you use the bumpers to move between left and right sets of things. And like figuring out how to internalize that is impossible because it changes depending on what the thing is you're doing. It's a mess. I've also not played that in like 2 weeks, so a week and a half, something like that. So fair enough. Are there other UIs that come to mind that are just like, I can't deal with this?
as much as I would really, I need to finish Outer Wilds. I know that it's good. Everyone's told me it's good. I went ahead and read the whole plot summary knowing that I would feel different once I experienced it myself, but I just was too curious. I can't fly in that game. I can't do it. I know it's better with a, like, I know it's better with a controller.
I can't imagine doing it with mouse. Mouse and keyboard feels like it'd be impossible.
Man, but now I gotta hook up my fucking controller. You know? I don't wanna do that.
Fair.
I'm tired.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Jeffrey writes in and asks, "Dear Waypoint, I hope you're all doing well and staying well. A few days ago on Twitter, I saw a question about games crit that got me thinking, what does the games criticism industry need to elevate itself? So I ask all of you, what do you think is needed to elevate games crit in this new decade in your professional opinions?" How much time you got? Like,
My dude, I got a lot to say.
I guess what I'll start with is actually, like, I think there's a lot of really good games crit right now. I think now versus 10 years ago, there's probably a broader amount of games crit than ever. Mm-hmm. But I think the path forward for getting it paid is tougher than ever, or is a lot of the paths that I think a decade ago or 5 years ago, even when like Gita and I were freelancing, the things that we thought would happen or we hoped would happen happened, and it didn't change anything. It didn't actually forge a way for games crit to be adapted or adopted by a larger audience. It didn't lead to there being, so I guess I'll get specific, which is like, when I think about the early 2010s through the mid 2010s, what I think we saw was a lot of emerging game critics who felt like there was not a place for their work to go other than their personal blogs or one or two small sites, if they were not full-time employees, right? So like Paste published a lot of games criticism. They paid very humbly as a long-term Paste writer at the time. At the time, they were not paying great rates, but they were paying me, and that was better than me just putting it on my blog. There were places that were publishing longer-form games crit. And by games crit, what I mean specifically is stuff that is not reviews, is not features. I think reviews fit into the world of games crit, but at the time specifically, what I think a lot of people wanted were things that did not come down to, is this worth a purchase? And game reviews on major publications or in major publications were still fundamentally about purchase decision. Even when I was writing, I still had to come back around to like, what is this thing? Is this thing worth your time, etc.? Whereas criticism can be a little broader, can have a thesis that goes beyond this thing's fundamental value, and can say, hey, this thing does this specific thing. And at the time, it was lots of blogs. It was sites like Paste and like a couple of other ones that were publishing stuff like that from freelancers. And then some people who had full-time jobs were able to have a column or able to have, you know, once a week or twice a week, they would be able to do something crit-related on top of their normal news writing or on top of their normal reviews or whatever. And at the beginning of the decade, it was mostly white dudes, right? There were absolutely really influential women and people of color who were you know, non-binary people who were writing. It was not just like white dudes, cis white dudes, but in terms of salaried roles, instead of the kind of bad paychecks from small websites, it was very much one thing. And I think by the mid of the decade, and Gita, you can back me up on this probably, we were like, all right, we have made a splash as independent freelancers. We're getting a chance to do some writing, and we're starting to get hired in real roles at places, which means that we should have time to mentor voices like ours, to spread our wings a little bit. And that experience has been like so frustrating because what I've seen is great criticism being published for the last 5 years on a variety of sites, including ones that were like direct competitors of Waypoints, right? Like I was reading everything Kotaku was doing. Publishes, right? Like I definitely, right? And
in our Slack, we were regularly talking about how much we love Waypoints shit. We're very jealous of you guys.
Well, guess what? No one else was. the audience is small, right? Like the lesson that I learned from doing this for years was the biggest hit games crit piece that you can do pales in comparison to, and I want to be clear, a well-reported feature, I don't just mean like the quick hit blog stuff. The quick hit blog stuff also does really well, right? The quick take does can do better if it's timely. You know, I think about like Patrick writing a piece that was mad about something in Red Dead Redemption being like the most hits we've gotten. We got that 1 month, like the January right after Red Dead came out. And it was like a thing he threw off and he had no idea it would do as well, but it totally resonated because people were curious. We're talking about Red Dead and that was going to do way better. And this is not me dragging Patrick, because Patrick is smart and understands how to play the game, right? But that piece did way better than any column we published that month. Way better, way better. I don't mean it did better. I don't mean like you watch a football game and it's like, you know, 33-30. I mean, like, you watch a football game and it's like 300-3. You know, like the scales that we're talking about are dramatically different. And what I came to learn over the time period is like, yes, there is an audience for games criticism. It is not big enough to make Games Crit a cornerstone of any major publication. There has to be another valve. There has to be another source for money to come in, because the audience isn't there. There's no version of it where, like, if only the GameScript was better, there'd be, like, no, the audience isn't there yet. Maybe it will be in 10 years. And that, I don't want to be like, I don't want to sound like a downer about this stuff, but
the only way I've gotten my stuff to land is framing it as internet culture. For some reason, when you frame game community stuff as internet culture, people's brains switch on and they suddenly get it.
Well, but you hit a different audience in that case, right? Because then you're hitting an audience, which was the pitch behind Waypoint to begin with, was like, we're going to publish stories that hit an audience that goes beyond the gamer and hits people who understand games because they were raised with games, but maybe don't play every new release, right? And what we found was like, no, mostly those people don't care unless it's really, really knock it out the park, incredible story, you know? Which is tough.
And it's concurrently, I was learning a lot of the same lessons at Kotaku, where learning how to report, learning about journalism, learning basically being thrown into the deep end of the pool and forced to do journalism immediately, taught me how to understand trends and like how to sort of Mary Poppins my criticism into someone's mouth by using a trending topic in gaming, perhaps. You know, it's you begin thinking about stuff like that, thinking about I can use this current conversation happening in the community as a jumping off point for a broader conversation about XYZ. And that's the only sort of foothold I've had to understand, like I've tried to, in which I can get people interested in these concepts. Or, I mean, by essentially, I mean, the other thing is, like, I've been thinking about this a lot because I'm sort of straddling both Motherboard and Vice Gaming. And when I write about internet culture stuff for a broader audience, it's, I don't want to disrespect or leave behind the original communities that create all of this stuff that I'm talking about.
You don't
want
to talk down to them or talk. You don't want to. Again, one of the. If I pulled up our, like, you know, vision doc for what Waypoint was, we never ever. And in fact, one of the earliest criticisms I made to Vice's documentary games coverage at the time, Vice had done like an esports doc. And it was very much like, whoa, can you believe people play video games for money? Can you believe people play video games in front of a crowd? And it's like, yeah, yes, I can, because we're in the crowd. Like, we are the you can't be outside looking in on this shit, because it's really, really insulting, and you'll end up alienating the community that you want to speak to instead of speaking to them. So yeah, that was a huge part of it for me, Gita, for sure. That balance of like, how do I talk about this group without how do I talk about what's happening here for a wider audience than the people here without alienating the people here? For what it's worth, and like, this is the turn, here's what I think the next decade looks like. I think we see an extension of, what I've learned is I don't know that it's doable in the model that requires advertising dollars to be spent, that requires your cornerstone stuff to get 500,000 to a million views, etc. What I think will happen is an extension of what already has started happening, which is more crowdfunded Games Crit, more insulated or insular but also supported community driven Games Crit, You know, it's easy to look at the success of things like Uppercut in the last couple of weeks. Uppercut had this really great big push on Patreon to as a crowdfunded thing to start paying freelancers through COVID. But I was going to say was Unwinnable has been around for 10 years. So it's not like there haven't been crowdfunded subscription-based games crit stuff happening for a long time, right? Bullet Points has been around for a while now. Abnormal Mapping has been around for a while now. That audience, those smaller audiences will find and support games crit, because the thing that's wild about this industry is the amount of people it takes to support a piece of, if I wrote something today, right? Let's just say, like, right now I sat down, I hammered out the best essay in my life, and it was about Umurangi Generation, right? And I put it out there. Top possible. My guess is 18,000 views if we publish it on Waypoint, right? Maybe 80,000 views. And if it really is just a stunning piece of incredible writing, 200 to 300,000 views. This is all like completely ballpark shit based on my past writing, based on how I've been able to gauge success. I've gotten more hits other places, but given, and depending on the topic, right? If I was writing it about GTA instead of about Umurangi, then let me tell you, it would be way better just because GTA has more pool. But if I was writing like the essay I wanted to write, the best version of it, that's what it would look like. You know, a website can't be built around someone doing, you know, 30 or 40 hours of work writing an essay that gets 18,000 hits. It can't. It will. It's not sustainable, right? The money doesn't add up, unfortunately. But if you take 18,000 readers and you say, well, what if 10% of them spent a dollar for this piece? Suddenly that money actually does add up. Which is weird because the market suggests that small amounts of people aren't supposed to be worth anything. But it turns out, and this is what my hope is for the next decade, is not necessarily that this is going to be sustainable. It's not that I think that this is like, and this is the good future for games criticism. What I actually mean is it's going to allow games criticism to continue happening at all. I don't think that raises the total number of readers by a huge proportion. I don't think that we're going to live in 2025 and like, everyone you know is going to have a deep understanding of like important game studies terms, or understand like the critical, like the history of critical literature, or understand why like terms like flow aren't necessarily useful because of developments in game studies, games crit, game design conversations, like things like that. We're not going to have a sea change in the amount of people who can have or interested in having interested in that style of games crit. But what I do think is possible is that these smaller audiences will continue to kind of glob together, support writers that they love, support video makers that they love, and move into a space where like that is the model. That's not me saying like, and that's more desirable than a world in which there was an outlet that had the money to throw at stuff. And there are outlets still paying for it. Like, I know Fanbyte is still commissioning stories like this. Like, I know that hopefully when Vice gives us freelance budget again, we will continue to commission stories like we were doing at one point. For me, that is like the path forward. Sorry to go on a rant about this. It has been on my mind a lot lately.
Sounds like you had something to say.
Yeah.
One thing I'll add is that one thing that I know is a problem across criticism, across, you know, all of media, is that it's just harder to be a minority in these spaces. It just is. I have now sort of I'm pretty disappointed, I guess I would say, with how change has happened over the past couple of years since I've been a writer, where the same people that I feel like want to, I can see them wanting to and expressing that they want to listen to and help, you know, writers of color, writers who are marginalized, who just have a harder time getting that first pitch accepted. I feel like we talk a lot about how to get more new voices, but we need to start thinking also about how to retain old voices and how to make sure that the spaces in which we work don't suffer from the exact same problems that we report on in the industry that we cover. I feel like for me, like, that is now going to be the drum that I bang incessantly until people find me really annoying.
Yeah, no, it turns out I quit, right? Like, I did. Yeah. I had 5 years of this in me. I came into this a year and I was like, I don't know if I have, a decade of games journalism in me. I had 5 years. I played out that 5 years. I'm still doing the podcast. Obviously, I'll still always probably write about video games because part of me can't help it. And that is the thing I end up telling so many people who ask about getting into the industry is like, if you want to, specifically about Games Crit, like, again, if you want to go the news hustle, there's more opportunities. I don't think news sites are going anywhere. If you want to get into videos, like, I think video isn't going anywhere. Though I think, I do wonder what the, I do think that Game Crit at large outlets, Game Crit video at large outlets will continue to be difficult. But the thing I tell those people is like, do it because you can't do anything else. Like, not because you can't do anything else, but you can't help but do it is really what I mean, right? Like,
yeah.
I can't help but play a game and be like, ooh, I need to talk about this. I need to write about this. I need to, like, get my ideas into an order that makes sense. But there is no money here. There is no career here. There isn't a way in which, like, listen, I came to Vice and was being paid $20,000 less than every other EIC here, right? The only time that money ever went up was one, two, this is just like mask off at this point. One, when they were trying to get me to stop doing Friends at the Table. And also, this is all people who aren't here anymore, right? This is like old leadership stuff. They're trying to get me to stop doing Friends at the Table. And so they're like, here, we'll give you $20,000 more. And that was still another $20,000 or $30,000 or $40,000 less than what some other EICs were making. But that was like, oh, we're going to start to bring you back up to where you are. Could you consider quitting doing this other thing that makes you they didn't say it in these terms. What they said is, we want to bring you 100% on board, which is wild. And that when I asked, like, what's that mean? They were like, we'd like you to either stop doing Friends at the Table or bring it in-house. And it's like, no, my friends own this. No, yeah. I don't ever do. Don't ever bring this up to me again. Because fuck off. And then the only other time I was able to get a raise here was by having an offer to go somewhere else and declining that offer, but, you know, needing to leverage that to get a raise. And it's like, that is, you're pulling teeth and you're doing it to then, like, write something no one is going to read, or that half of the people who read it are going to be like, you said the word Trump in this, so fuck you. Tell me more about the monsters, right? It's really demoralizing. It's a hard place to stay and to make your full-time gig, because it is not a particularly welcoming space writ large. We've been very lucky that I think we were surrounded by people. I'm very happy with the way that Waypoint, like, treated us, and, like, when I fucked up, believe me, they fucking held me to account when I was in the role of EIC. But by and large, there were lots of people who read things we wrote and who paid attention to us, and who I think if we'd had a direct-to-consumer, quote-unquote, a subscription option, I think we would have done very well. But I also know that that is, like, that isn't what a big company is going to want quite yet, you know? HBO Max ain't about to start, you know, offering Games Crit. Actually, maybe they are. Who the fuck knows what's on HBO Max? That thing's a mess.
Honestly, who the fuck knows what's on HBO Max? Uh-huh. I don't know.
That's the headline. Who the fuck HBO knows? Max. You were going to say something else, though, Gita.
It's, yeah, I mean, Maddie Myers, my friend, and also newly at Polygon, at doing, being
shout
everyone's
outs
boss,
to,
I think.
To Maddie, yeah.
Shout out to Maddie, love her. She... I completely lost my thought. Completely. Sorry. Let me start again. Maddie Myers, who's currently at Polygon, used to be with me at Kotaku, used to call video game journalism baby journalism for babies. That's what I was going for.
Ah, okay. I see.
And, you know, like, it's a partially, like, a self-effacing, like,
right, games journalist says, journalism. This, what I'm doing is baby journalism, is different than saying it from the outside.
Yeah, but it's also, like, when you look at the challenges that games journalists are put through, and to the extreme, like, vitriol on the other side that you receive for doing normal shit that shouldn't be so shocking or upsetting to people, you really just start to feel like, you know, like, what? You just start to feel like I could be writing about something else and making a lot more money, and why am I not doing that?
For me, it comes back to me of being like, I do care about this shit. That's why I'm doing it. It isn't for the money. There is no money in this. What there is fulfillment. And for what it's worth, I do think that like the breadth of expressions that we can see inside of GamesCrit is better now than it has been before. Like there is.
Oh, absolutely.
It's 100%. So like, it's not me saying like there's a net negative here. But what there hasn't been is a change that seems like there is no class of GamesCrit coming out of the last 10 years of development in the critical space. What there is like if there is a class, that class is transient. That class is people who do freelance work for a few years, maybe get a staff position for a while, then have a medical bill they have to pay. And so they have to start looking for a job that has better benefits, or they're looking for something a little more stable, or something that like doesn't put them in the line of fire from hate squads because someone didn't like a tweet that had a rewrite of a headline that the author didn't even see until the piece went live, right? Like that stuff is rough. And it goes back to what you were saying, Gita, of like, if the first step was here is what's happened over the last decade is there's now a bigger pool than ever of people doing GamesCrit. That pool is more diverse than ever. These are improvements. But that pool is now just like being run through. And increasingly with COVID especially, there is less and less freelance budget to even go around. And so it's not like there's a home for those people. It's more like these people are people who can be slotted in for a season, do the job. You know, you can shuffle through as many of them as you want. Lots of them have incredible voices and would really benefit from a full-time job at a place. In terms of changing culture, in terms of helping, but it seems really hard to see a world in which that happens from the inside of the industry out, instead of what I think will probably happen, which is one of these Patreon funded, crowdfunded sites will actually probably grow until it becomes a little bit bigger, until it becomes even a more. I mean, obviously, Giant Bomb did this with video content a decade ago, and live streams and you know, Let's Play content and Quick Looks and blah blah blah. But I can imagine one of the Patreon sites out there hitting in a big way. But that isn't systemic change either, right? That isn't like then that becomes the model.
Systemic change would involve like a revolution of the entire media industry, which no one has really figured out how to adequately monetize.
Totally,
so you'd have to start there. But that systemic change and education serves least marginalized people amongst it's years and years and years of work, naive of me that I couldn't think that I could have done it all by myself, which I definitely did think.
Well, you should have thought that wasn't gonna do it either.
That was good. I mean, god, I was willing to just
you gotta get out of bed every morning
under the train tracks.
Totally. That's the thing is, right, you tell yourself like I have to do this right now because I'm trying to pave a way for blah 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 blah, and then you get to the end and you're like, shit, they took all the pavement away. They fucking put dirt all over the pavement again.
It's like, shit, I gotta start all over. Like younger writers talk about being treated in ways that I remember being treated by editors, just like dismissed,
sometimes
ignored.
By the same editors. Like, it sucks.
Sometimes by the same freaking editors. It's disappointing. It makes you sad. I shouldn't say disappointing. It does suck. And it feels unjust to me.
Yeah. There is a part of it that's tough because it's like, I think in the middle of doing it all, it's easy to – and I know we're like really navel-gazy here right now, but I know some people enjoy that, so I'm going to keep going. it is easy to convince yourself that you are part of systemic change when in fact you are the exception to the rule. And that can defang you and declaw you a little bit because it's like, the change I want is coming. It's here. I'm part of it. When in fact, it's like the change that I want is a decade, 2 decades away, requires changes in the education system in your country, requires changes in, like you said, the entire media landscape, the way that media functions, changes in the way social media functions. And all of that is a big ask when like what you want is to be able to be paid a living wage for writing stuff that, you know, a few dozen thousand people enjoy. I don't know. I think my suggestion as readers, not that, again, I mean, part of this here is, right, you cannot fix this. If everyone who listened to this podcast, like, said, all right, I'm gonna go support a Patreon right now, that wouldn't fundamentally fix the problem of games crit in the industry. What it would do is put a lot of money into writers' hands, help some particular marginalized voices, help games crit to continue to survive. And so for me, my suggestion is like you can't necessarily enact the change that's going to overnight fix everything, but you can do what you can do to help games crit continue to thrive. And so look around, go look at like what sort of freelance or crowdfunded based stuff is out there. Again, I've mentioned some already, places like Unwinnable, Uppercut,
Honestly, Critical Distance still rounds up some really, really good lesser known crit. They started branching out and rounding up stuff that I write too, but I go there to read about the stuff from writers that I have not heard of yet.
Totally. Rebind was the one that I was just thinking of that also does good stuff. Abnormal Mapping. A bunch of great podcasts there. Some good writing from the folks there too. Again, Unwinnable is something that's been around for a decade, but that doesn't mean that it doesn't require or need support. People should go check that out. And like you said, Critical Distance itself has its own Patreon, right? And it's worth supporting them because of the curatorial work that they do. I said bullet points before, like it goes on and on and on. I know I'm missing people, and it fucks me up that I'm like, I did not come in prepared for this question with notes all ready to go. but look around, try to find stuff that speaks to you. Find stuff that like, hey, this is the sort of thing that I really like. That's my suggestion. And that's kind of what I think. What the fuck do I know? I don't work here anymore. You know, like, I don't even go here.
Still on the podcast.
I'm still on the podcast, but like, you know what I mean? Like, I'm not looking at daily numbers anymore. I'm not buried in stats.
Right.
But that is what I think this next decade looks like. And I hope GameScript continues to do well. And I hope, you know, as well as it can in terms of the quality of writing. And I think we are going to continue to see really strong writing. I just wish we lived in a world where I was confident those writers would get paid, you know?
Yeah.
Or paid well, paid enough to live on. So it goes. With that.
Sorry.
What's up?
No, I was just going to say, it definitely feels like there's even more of a, not just... It's both things, both a growing audience, but also a growing kind of base of writers interested in this because of an expansion in academia, which is this kind of double-edged, like, there's more people interested in writing this stuff, and we'll also probably consume more of it, but it's harder to support the one number of more writers existing with the one number of more readers existing, like...
Yeah. Those numbers just don't... as Jay-Z once said, you're a candle in the sun. That shit don't even out. that's how it is.
Yeah.
All right. On that downer note, on this downer week, I think we should wrap it up. We'll be back next week with more. I will probably end up missing an episode next week also. We'll see. I'm staring down some deadlines. Some deadlines. They're exciting deadlines. One day I'll talk about these deadlines, I'm sure. I cannot do that yet, but I hope people have a good, safe weekend. As always, you can send those questions into gaming@vice.com. You can also go to waypoint.zone/BOEN to listen to Miss You, the track off of the EP Pale Machine by Bowen, which we use as our theme. You can find me on Twitter @Austin_Walker. You can follow Waypoint, twitter.com/Waypoint. Gita, where can people find you?
You can find me at XOXOGossipGita on Twitter and Instagram.
And Kato.
At @A_Kato_appears and also put question in the subject so that it hits the filters for those questions.
Please do. Yes. Yeah. Otherwise, it's hard for me to see them. Thank you. Thank you for noting that. Otherwise, I have to go diving through spam emails that hit the same feed. It hit the same email, and I don't see it because people are trying to sell us junk or whatever. All right, everybody. As always, fuck capitalism in every meaning of the word. Go home. Peace.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
And I sell this list of knife manufacturers that were at a certain convention. I guess conventions aren't happening anymore.
No, that's why you need the list of knife manufacturers. You gotta figure out who am I supposed to talk to about knives? Normally, I just go to the knife convention.
Yeah, the knife con.
Usually, I do just go to the knife convention.
Normally, I just go to the knife con. Yeah,
knife con. Yeah, you're a cool.
Is this a real thing?
Knife con.
I'm sure it is.
Yeah,
remember the knife channel that everyone got obsessed with watching for a while?
Show. Knife channel. Knife show is great. Shout out to the knife show.
Man, I love the knife show. Kato, do you know what this is?
No, but I just Googled Knife Con, and the first thing says knives at Knife Center. That's the funniest thing to me right now, but it fucking
why is.
Why
is it
oh,
so
also
funny.
The second one is called MegaKnife.com. Love it.
I need a mega knife.
Gotta get me a mega knife. 30 for the clap, if people time that is. You got 5 seconds still.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm ready.
Okay. I'm not. I don't have anything
to do with it. Excellent.
I'm just happy it's not me this time.
Yeah. All right. 50?
Sure. Sounded good.
I'm Gita.
Sound like
and I did clap.
Clap.